ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
One of the great mistakes a lot of the political and media class are making at the moment is just presuming that the orthodoxies of politics still apply, and they really don't anymore, and they especially don't apply to One Nation.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party: change or die.
The public are sick and tired of being ignored.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation here in sunny Sydney.
Sunny. Showing off, are you? Always showing off.
Actually, I was. VK, look, we got a lot of questions today. Always got a lot of questions. Thank you, all of you. But I know party members want to know because they ask these questions too. Hell, I want to know. Where are you up to with the West Wing? I know there's a lot of seasons, but are you there yet?
Nah, not there yet. Towards the end of the fourth season.
Oh, you got miles to go, haven't you?
That's the way we like it. You see, I've tried to explain to this. My daughter's in year 11 and she studies a lot. And so we have a rule where we only watch it on the weekend. So we can't do the binging in the weeknights because there's schoolwork to do. And she's very militant about it, which I'm very proud of actually, because I'm like, well, I wish I had that discipline. So what I can tell you is that Bartlett's been re-elected for a second term and Sam Seaborn is running now in for the Senate. And there's a lot of shenanigans going on and they've killed a foreign leader secretly by changing some rules, and a journalist is onto it. And I'm like, and my daughter and I, like, you know, having fights over who we're barracking for, because I'm very much on the journalist's side trying to expose it. But of course, she's very attached to this administration and its success, and she's worried about it being revealed, Fran. So, like, it's deep here.
Yeah, it's an interesting moral dilemma. I get that.
No, there's only one answer, which is it should be exposed and you shouldn't kill foreign leaders.
Yeah, unless, but Bartlett of course, and Sam Seaborn, they're very, you know, we're invested, right?
We're invested in the truth being told.
Of course we are. Sorry.
Yeah. Good.
Sorry.
Thank you. Come on my side, because her and I have different interests.
Because I'm a journalist.
Yes, that's the thing. Hey, what have you been watching?
Well, I have been binging. In fact, I had a sick day the other day and I was laid up. So I sat on the couch and I watched all six episodes of a new season, brand new on SBS, called Kabul. It is fantastic.
Oh, that is so Fran Kelly.
It is fantastic. It tells the story of that day or two after the Taliban rolled into town. And I was reporting, you know, from Sydney. I remember doing an interview with a young woman called Marwa, who was holed up in her apartment in Kabul with 30 other young women hiding from the Taliban. And, you know, her interview really, really connected with the audience. It was really powerful. And this is that time. And, you know, the fraught stories of those trying to escape, to get to safety, the families that were, it's just fantastic. I really, really recommend it. Hate the ads on SBS, but it's great.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I suppose that they're not as fully funded as the ABC. Hey, the bells are ringing. Should we do question time?
Let's do it.
We shall move to questions without notice. Are there any questions? I give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Yeah.
Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing. It means it's time for our question time. This week, our first question comes from Jasmine.
Hi, Party Room. Jasmine here. As we head towards the next election, I'm increasingly concerned about AI, deepfakes and algorithms interfering with democracy. How do you think this will play out during campaign time? And how should we as a country be preparing for this?
This is a fantastic question, Jasmine. I have been...
Right on the money, isn't it?
I'm obsessed with the way artificial intelligence is, well, disrupting everything, but will have a massive impact also on our next elections. And we're not talking about that enough. Like, did you see the other day our reporting of the deepfake and the one of Alan Kohler, our colleague, right? And even, and I'm sure he won't mind me saying, he's a sister podcast for us as well here at the ABC, you know, he was like even shocked by how close to him this looked. Like it was like it was him. So, you know, you think about deepfakes and their impact on politics. You could get Anthony Albanese deepfaked saying, I don't know, that he believes in death taxes, okay, which would of course be very, very, very dangerous to his re-election chances, and you could make it look very much like him.
We already are getting the Prime Minister saying all sorts of things. I mean, just this week, ASIC, the Australian Securities and Investment Commission, that's the corporate watchdog, confirmed that the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is the figure most commonly used in deepfakes to promote phony investment opportunities. Australians lost 7.4 million to the top impersonated figures. Albanese was top of the list, but there was also Angus Taylor was on that list. Also, Jackie Lambie was on that list. You can see the danger here, right? You know, some of the things that the Prime Minister is saying, encouraging people to invest money in government programs that are not actually government sanctioned programs, are not programs at all. It's particularly dangerous. And this is without, you know, the hotbed sort of atmospherics and the high stakes of an election campaign. So it's really, really quite scary. And the independent MP, Zali Steggall, has proposed a bill that would require AI-generated content that could mislead voters to be clearly identified. But, you know, it's not as easy as that. I mean, the deep fakers are way outsmarting not just the regulators but the tech experts who've, this is their whole life, is to investigate and to be able to verify or not these deep fakes, to spot them. I've spoken to one who basically says, you know, he's kind of given up because it the technology is better than he can do with all the tools that he has managed to invent and put in place.
And, of course, the problem is the way it's like a bushfire on social media. So, yes, you can try and police the use of them by political parties officially, but the kind of subterranean level at which this stuff works on and the proliferation of the spreading of this sort of stuff, I think, is very hard, truthfully, to police. And, yeah, you need the kind of cooperation of the tech companies. But look at a company like X. Do you think Elon Musk is you know, motivated by caring about, you know, the robustness of our electoral system and what's spreading on his? I don't think so. I see no evidence.
Not even motivated, but can they do it? I mean, there is a problem even around.
I reckon they can do a lot more if there was a will.
But look, of course they can do more than they are doing, of course. But our laws aren't up to date. I mean, there is no prohibition on the use of AI in election campaigning under the Commonwealth Electoral Act of 1918. The AEC is very alive to this risk too. But, you know, electoral laws do require certain campaign communication to feature authorisation statement. But there's no general truth in advertising laws that apply to federal campaign statements or policy claims. Our laws need to be updated. So I think, you know, the technology is running way ahead of the laws. We've got an election campaign. What is it now, PK? 18 months away, is it, or less?
Well, yeah, less.
And you know, we're going to need to get moving on this.
Yeah, I agree with you. Let's move to our next question, and it comes from Jan.
Hey, party. I love your pod, and I'm thinking about it as I'm walking along, and I've got this question. I think that it would be really amazing if people saw local politics and, to a lesser extent, state politics as a great place to retire to after having achieved amazing things in federal politics. You know, I could so see a ex-PM becoming a mayor, for example. Can this ever happen? Has this ever happened? Let me know.
I love this story, retiring to lesser office. Has it happened before? I'm not sure, Fran.
Yeah, it has. I mean, Philip Ruddock, who was a long-term Howard government minister, very high profile, he became a local mayor, the mayor for Hornsby, I think, in Sydney in 2024. We've got a number of MPs and former ministers who've gone across to state politics.
Well, kind of down to. It's not unfair to say that. I think the federal politics is the pinnacle, isn't it?
Okay, I'm not going there, but,
okay.
You know.
I think it is.
And there are many cases of that. And I think it was interesting, there was a time not that long ago when the former Foreign Minister, Alexander Downer, was touted to run for Liberal leader in South Australia because that party's in terrible straits there. He didn't do that.
Erica Betts is the treasurer, isn't he, in Tasmania?
That's exactly right. Mark Latham, of course, former Labor leader federally, is in the New South Wales Parliament. And I would say, PK, there's a lot of eyes are on the South Australian current Premier, Peter Malinauskas, because a lot of people reckon he looks like future PM material.
Oh, that's the other way around, though.
That's the other way around, but it happens both ways. So, you know, that's all I'm saying. It does happen.
Yeah, the other way around is more the way it happens, though. If you look at someone like Bob Carr, who, of course, was New South Wales Premier and kind of like very successful New South Wales Labor Premier and then came into the federal parliament, ended up being Foreign Affairs Minister, right? So, you know, I think that's the normal way rather than the other way around, although as you just pointed out, there are, you know, lots of examples as it turns out. I don't know. I have a feeling when it comes to the prime ministerial level that the idea that Anthony Albanese wants to be the mayor of Marrickville is unlikely, although...
I don't know. Did you ever see Rats in the Rain?
Yes. That,
just saying,
say,
everyone, if you get a moment, check it out on YouTube. It's
hard recommend on that one, hard recommend. But it is an interesting thing. I don't know. My own view is that you should have a go and then let other people have a go. I find the kind of compulsiveness of needing to always be, you know, I'll give you an example. At the moment, there are rumours swirling, and they're rumours, that's why I've used that term, that Tony Abbott would like to be a politician again. Now, definitely I have from a couple of sources that he expressed that interest to Peter Dutton, who was not interested.
Right? Gee, I wonder why.
I cannot confirm whether he's expressed that to Angus Taylor. But imagine that, right? Like he tries to get a seat into the lower house, or I think it's probably only at a national level he's probably interested. He's the president at the moment. You know, it is overshadowing Angus Taylor in many ways. You kind of need to move on a bit.
Yeah.
Like I just think,
when you're gone, you're gone.
Give
That's
the next
what you
guy
think.
A bit of a turn, or next lady. I meant guy in the generic way, by the way. All right, my next question, or your next question that we're going to try and answer, is from Imogen.
Hi, Fran and PK. Love the podcast and all your hard work. Reflecting on increasing activism, particularly the anti-One Nation and anti-right-wing protests earlier this month, how is the role and influence of young politically minded people changing in the newly charged, divisive and aware political climate? How much change can they actually make, and what is actually effective in getting their message across? Thanks, Imogen from Nipaluna, Tassie.
Imogen, it's a good question, and I can tell, you know, you're young and you've probably been to protests. I mean, protests, it's an age-old mechanism, right? Remember the Vietnam War protests? They were so huge eventually that they did have an impact on governments of the day. But I think, you know, there were student protests against Pauline Hanson last week. It's a while since we've seen something like that, but we have seen the climate protests with the kids going out on the streets and leaving the schools and protesting about climate change. But these things make the news headlines, and these things have an impact perhaps on, not always positive, on general population and the sentiment, but the influence and power of young people at the moment, particularly at this moment, I would say, PK, is in their vote or in their impending vote if you're under 18, because millennials and Gen Z voters now comprise 47% of the electorate. That was at the last election. So that's nearly half of the voters are younger voters. There'll be more than 47% at the next election, 2028. So it's a very significant group. Politicians have to be listening. They have to fight for their vote. You know, One Nation is even looking there, and it's attracting, according to some of the polls, some of that vote, which hadn't happened before. So, you know, this is a very significant voting bloc now, Imogen. So I think you can rest assured that youth protests around issues are being looked at by the current political crop harder than they perhaps were 10 years ago.
I agree with that. Also, I just want to make an observation that a friend of mine was reflecting with me the other day. So, you know, my age group kind of people have teenagers broadly. Obviously, you have different age kids, but, you know, and that is the cohort, not all, it depends, there's political diversity in that group, but that cohort that is, you know, protesting against Pauline Hanson or against hardline views on immigration, that sort of stuff, yeah. And this friend was saying to me, can you believe, and this is a broader thing about the legacy of Hanson herself, really, as a figure, that she said, I protested against Pauline Hanson in the 90s and my daughter, and her daughter's like, I don't know, 18 I think now, but is protesting against Pauline Hanson now at that those student protests, right? That's wild.
That is wild. Look, I also think protest is sort of back in. I don't want to play it.
Is
now,
it back but, in? Is you reckon it's back in fashion?
Well, in the sense that it's so much easier now to have group communication, so you can organise, you can get a message out, you can organise. But we've seen that happening. You know, it's turbocharged since then. But it happened in the protests at Tahrir Square in Egypt and in other places that you can get the message out and people can come together. But we have also seen a raft of pretty tough anti-protest laws coming in around the country, particularly in New South Wales. And so I think there hasn't actually been enough debate around this at the moment, that the way the laws have toughened up, protest, the right to protest has been really stripped back, and that's, you know, that's going to have an impact on democracy, and young voters are emerging into that environment. So I think we'll see more about that and more pushback on that because it's happened quite quickly in response to, you know, after Bondi in particular, the Bondi terror attack and the Gaza protests. So I think, you know, this is something that's gone a little under the radar and probably deserves a little bit more sunlight.
Yeah, definitely a lot more sunlight. Our next question comes from Sean.
Hi, PK and Fran. It's Sean from the Sunshine Coast. Firstly, I'm loving the Politics Now podcast. I think it serves a really important role. And I love the variation in terms of different PK. You're definitely a constant, but kind of different people through the week. Keep it up. It's really important. My question is about just this recent announcement from Coalition, and I think, and it's mimicking what One Nation have said about reducing immigration, capping immigration based on housing supply. I'm confused. I thought that whilst immigration has some role to play in our housing shortage, so much of it is about declining productivity in construction, state government's not opening up land quickly enough, shortage of skilled labour, there's a whole bunch of things. It just feels to me that they're once again, they're targeting immigration for something that it's not to blame for, not primarily to blame for. It would be great to get your thoughts on this. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Sean. Yes, I'm glad you're enjoying Politics Now every day. And of course, the Party Room is our, what do they call it? Our standout product or something, you know, marketing-ish.
Marquee. Let's call it a marquee product. It's the original premium, the best. That's premium. What I always say.
Lara, who is our producer of all of the politics shows here in the podcast world, says premium product.
Well, Lara is our premium product, to be
She's
honest, if you ask
premium
me.
Premium because she has to deal with us and our mental brains. Can I say, I think this is a really interesting, like, so you're confused about the housing linked to immigration and also the Chasing One Nation. I'm just going to do this because I think it's only fair. The Coalition, even in the last election, was obsessed with immigration and talking about immigration. So I'm not saying there hasn't been any trying attempt at sort of aping a bit of One Nation, but to be fair to them, some of them were kind of on to this being a thing that was annoying people earlier than Pauline Hanson
and
started.
And making that link to housing and infrastructure, right?
Yeah. Like, I don't think it's just quite as simple as that, although I will absolutely confirm that the optics at the moment is that everyone is chasing the sort of narratives that One Nation puts forward. That is the political play, and it looks like that, right? But I think it's a bit more complex. In terms of housing and immigration, even Labor, and everyone's got their different ideas about how to deal with immigration, but even Labor concedes that, of course, housing and immigration have some links. And I'm glad they do say that and everyone says that, because I think everyone's brain can figure out that the number of people you have in a country and the number of supply of the housing must have some link. The question you asked, though, is about the level. And I think that's a really good question, because I think there has been an exaggeration that immigration is at the heart of the problem with housing. I don't think that's quite true. I think the amount and number of houses we've been making for a long time, building, the sort of cumbersome productivity issues that you raise around actually even getting them up and going, all of that, our tax and policies, our rents are going up at the moment, all of that is all part of it. I mean, it's like anything, there are about 200 columns that lead to something. But immigration is one of the columns, and we can't say it's not one of the columns, because the number of people you have going for the number of houses that exist is always going to be an issue. You can't say it's not. Don't you agree, Fran?
Well, that's true, but I think if you look at the figures, and I had a look at it, Sean, after I saw your question, you know, all the economists and the modelling shows that that immigration has, and I think they use this term a lot, a modest impact on the price of housing, because this came up in terms of affordability first, to some extent. First home buyers couldn't get in the market. It was, you know, way out of their reach, and immigrants were blamed for buying houses. That's actually a tiny, tiny impact on house prices, just over 1%, I think, is what economists agree on. But on rents, it's a different story, because most immigrants, most people coming here, whether they're foreign students or skilled migrants coming short term, they're renting something like 67%, I think it is, or something over 60% of people come here as migrants are renting. So it does have an impact on the availability of rents. And of course, that has an impact on the price of your rent and rents going up. And we have seen significant price hikes in our rents. So I think it's that sector. We can't pretend it's not having an impact. But it's just one of the factors, right? Mm. The overall overarching most significant factor is housing supply. We don't have enough houses. We're something like 250,000 houses short. We need to be building more. And that's proving difficult because of construction costs, and we don't have enough construction workers, and we don't have enough land available. So it's local councils, planning rules, and it's supply. But certainly I think people would agree that immigration levels do have an impact on the rental market in particular.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's what I mean by the columns. Like, you know, for a long time, I think the biggest problem was that there was too much of a dismissing of its impact. And now I think the opposite problem, there's been an overhype of its impact. You know, like we've kind of, the politicians, based on their agendas, of course, have failed to get the kind of the truth, the balance right of how much it's being impacted on it. But either way, I think people are concerned, and that's why you're seeing the reaction even from Labor to deal with kind of high numbers of immigration. Well, that's it for our special episode of The Party Room today. Keep sending your questions in, though. We like getting them. They always kind of make parts of my brain work that have been dormant, so thank you. We're particularly fond of your voice notes, which you can email to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Yeah, we do love them. It's kind of like a gym workout for your brain, isn't it, PK? You know, you come across a lot of information when you've been following politics for as long as we have, and you've got a lot of information. So it's good sometimes to just haul it back in front and centre. So thanks, everyone, for your questions. Remember, David Spears will be back for Insiders on Background on Saturday, and he's speaking to the former Border Force and AFP Commissioner Rowan Pike about the tobacco tax, because that is a hot issue right now, again, being, you know, front-led by One Nation. And then you'll be back with Politics Now on Monday, PK.
You can be sure of it. Yeah, I'll be back. And also, please follow Politics Now on ABC Listen. Share it with your friends. If you haven't shared it with your friends, what are you doing with your time? See you, Fran.
See you, PK.